Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Lowe's knows you've got a job to do, and we help get it done. With the MyLowe's Pro Rewards program, eligible members save more. With volume discounts on qualifying orders through a quote of $2,000 or more. Join for free today. Lowe's. We help you save. Offer can't be combined with any other discount, contract, and or special pricing. Exclusions, more terms, and restrictions apply. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Scott Shepherd, founder and CEO of the City's First Podcast. I am very excited to have with me today a panel of really esteemed guests, all from the West Coast of the U.S., in public and private, really to talk about everything related to AI and data in mobility, as well as other aspects of urbanism and city functions. This webinar is really thematic and timely because we're going to be hitting upon a lot of topics that relate to drivers in the public sector, regulations, as well as use cases ranging from electric vehicles to autonomous vehicles to AI in government functions, et cetera. So I'm really happy to have with you all here our panel, which comprises three guests. First is Camille Terry, who is the CEO of Charger Help based out of Los Angeles. So welcome, Camille. How are you?
Good morning. Hi.
Okay. Next, we have Rob Loy, the Chief Technical Officer with the City of Seattle, Washington. Rob, welcome.
Good morning.
And then also with the City of Seattle, Washington, we have Jason Cambridge, who is heading up technology, the technology manager. So welcome, Jason.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Great. And just last but not least, this episode is sponsored by UMX by EIT Urban Mobility. So Urban Mobility Explained is one of the foremost platforms for urban mobility continuing education, sponsored by the EIT Urban Mobility Program and the European Commission. So there are dozens of videos as well as short form content on the UMX website that you can download or register for free, as well as share with your colleagues related to kind of upskilling your knowledge base in terms of urban mobility, transportation, anything related to kind of the digital economy. And you can follow all of their content on www.urbanmobilityexplained.eu. So with that, we're going to just kick this off and get started. As everyone knows, our standard kind of City's First format and theme, we're going to go through about 4 or 5 high-level topics. We'll open it up to the panel here. It'll be a really nice exchange conversation. We'll take some questions, if applicable, from the audience Q&A, and then we'll kind of close it out and talk about our next episode. So with that, we're just going to kick it off with the first topic or question, and this will be to you, Camille, which is, how does mobility data, including data from people, vehicles, and infrastructure, and let's focus on, you know, your experience in Los Angeles, which also happens to be my hometown, is transforming urban transportation planning, maybe from an electrical vehicle perspective?
Sure. Well, thank you all so much for having me. To my background, Charger Help, we've been really focused on reliability of infrastructure. And we've been doing that through the large collection of data from the field and also through the cloud. We do this because today when we see that when we're deploying public infrastructure, oftentimes this is our first time decentralizing fuel and then also putting fuel into a smart asset like a charging station. And so when we start thinking about mobility data and data and information, it now becomes the crux of the conversation because these assets are really computers. I was chatting with someone the other day and they said, yeah, like your new electric vehicle or even the cars that you're getting have more lines of code than the code that was needed in order to get to do Apollo 13. So we are all driving around with computers, right? And so when you drive around with computers, you and you're interacting with computers in order to get access to a fueling source, data is the most important thing. And so at Charger Hill, we're using it in order to ensure that if there's ever any issues, that we're able to solve those things faster. But I think for cities and also other fleet operators, really transitioning their mind to understand that these assets that are in our environment now aren't just, you know, steel and concrete and whatever have you, that they are now connected to a digital world, which opens up us to a lot of opportunity, but also, of course, open us up to a lot of risk.
Great. Thanks, Camille, for that. Let's throw this question to Jason. What are your thoughts on this topic?
Yeah, thanks, Scott. So, at SDOT, our mission is to provide a safe and reliable and sustainable transportation experience. And we're definitely trying to reduce congestion, but also safely and reliably connect people on foot or on bikes or, with transit and efficiently move goods through our city. And, we also have an extensive network of devices to perform traffic management. We've been doing this for over 40 years, modifying a traffic signal timing remotely. And then we have hundreds of cameras to observe the traffic. We have a robust kind of command and control infrastructure environment and staff to respond to both, planned and unplanned events. And so cameras are at the center of this, and the pairing of camera technology with AI has been truly transformational for our industry. I was at a conference recently and just astounded going through the vendor trade show portion. Just so many startups and well-established companies that are using computer vision. So the computer vision, it kind of acts as the brain to the eyes of the camera, and it's just giving us a greater understanding of the intersection than ever before. The models just become smarter and smarter. They can really accurately distinguish a pedestrian from a bicyclist, eventually a scooter rider from cars and heavy trucks, et cetera, which is really just giving us a greater understanding of the intersection and corridor operation than ever before. And I would say another, compelling source of data is from connected vehicles. So a lot of information we've collected has been very hardware dependent over the years, like speed and travel time data, which is a maintenance burden for sure. But now there are big data operators like Here.com and TomTom that purchase anonymized rolled up data from navigation providers and OEMs. And so now using this product, we have citywide speed and travel time data, origin and destination data, just a very complete view of the where our network is performing in a highly dynamic fashion. So yes, in the past, I'd say 6 to 7 years, what has traditionally been a highly manual method of understanding how our streets are operating has become very much digitized. And yeah, super exciting about the future.
Computer vision is a game changer. I know certainly in micromobility, one of my former consultants, we were all about AI and computer vision for object detection and machine learning to really understand the built environment, understand sidewalks, objects, three-dimensional objects, two-dimensional objects, and really how cities can use that data as well as operators, private operators, to better communicate to city, the status of, let's say, compliance with regulations, parking, geofencing, et cetera, et cetera. Use cases go way beyond just micromobility. But yeah, I would agree, Jason. Just in the last 6 or 7 years, we, especially since the pandemic, it's been quite a paradigm shift. Camera-based technologies are probably leading the way, but there's a variety of kind of heterogeneous sensors out there that kind of provide that that mix. And it's interesting to see, how those will be paired together in a public-private collaboration going forward. Who's the owner of the data? Who maintains it? What are the let's say privacy regulations? Obviously, here in Europe, we have GDPR. In the US, it's all regulated at the state level, if at all. So there's a whole mix and match. And I think certain cities, such as Seattle, are certainly taking the lead. So it's great to hear that. So maybe expanding upon that, Rob, maybe you can put the cherry on top and give us a little bit of the another view in terms of what Jason has shared.
Yeah, I think both of those points go to a couple themes of where data, AI, and other things are taking us in terms of access to transportation, its flow management to make sure a city runs well. There's the safety piece of it, which is Vision Zero. And also, a city has communities have an interest in economic reactivation. And so, where we're seeing transportation go is there's audiences and investments in all four of those channels. But what allows us to have smart investments is there's opportunity in all four of those that we haven't had before, to Jason's point and to Camille's point. Where we can invest in infrastructure and give people in transportation deserts the ability to have electrified transportation. We've never actually been able to see that before or give people that kind of opportunity. And there's been grants in the last few years that were never available before. That was a game changer in some areas, even electric bikes. And Denver showed a great model for that, and the uptake was phenomenal. Also, the Vision Zero impacts. Most communities were unable to show really strong progress to Vision Zero goals for a long time, but with these tools, we're actually starting to be able to show some bending of the curve. And then economic reactivation after COVID and kind of the annus horribilis of 2020 and 2021. Every major community is looking about how do I transform what used to work as an economic model in a downtown core, and transportation is a core part of that tool set of how do you run a city and generate revenue when the economics of a city has changed. And AI is kind of a two-sided coin there, is it liberates where people can work and is changing how jobs are going to be. But also, we have this major infrastructure of where cars will go and people go. So there's a lot in flux, is all I'm saying. How cities, companies, nonprofits, data providers are working together is, I think, the biggest puzzle we have right now, because how AI works is data, and it rides on how it's collected, how fast it's current, and who gets to make models that work based on it. And that's also up in the air.
Yeah, it comes down to stewardship, ownership, as well as what models, whether a commercial business economic model or a regulatory policy model, will kind of best implement those four pillars that you had mentioned, Rob. What's near and dear to my heart as an urban planner designer is really about reactivation of economic zones, as well as kind of neighborhood centers, whether we want to say the 15-minute city, or we want to say areas that started experimenting, I would say, with giving public spaces back to people, certainly during and after the pandemic, whether they be open streets programs, whether they be cycle lanes, et cetera. Many cities in North America and the US have reverted back to the autocentric model, not to sound negative, but it's true. So I think that cities that can find a path forward, either through grants, pilot programs, partnerships, and threading the needle with the best use and stewardship of technology to accomplish these policy goals and better reconfigure our built environment and public spaces is a win-win for everyone. But again, it is a puzzle, or to be a little bit more blunt about it, it's a bit of a muddled landscape right now, and it's yet to be seen. The opportunities and possibilities are there, but we do need to chart a clear course that puts, let's say, citizens first, though. I would say that's really, I think, something as a key takeaway. So, with that, I think let's kind of segue to our next topic here, which is around tools. So, let's throw this back to Camille again, but I will alternate the order as we go through here. But I think I'd like to have Camille answer this one at first. So, what are some of the emerging AI tools in mobility to improve accessibility, equity, safety, and efficiency, above and beyond kind of what we talked about, maybe perhaps what you've seen locally in Los Angeles?
Sure. What I will say is that we haven't seen a ton deployed. I think that a lot of folks are currently building things. But what I
Yeah,
want
but
to talk
or what's the dearth? What's the absence of
about.
it? What do we need?
Yes. I mean, I'll talk specifically about transportation on the electric vehicle side and infrastructure. We see across the nation that about 30% of the infrastructure can be inoperable. We consistently see that about 90% of those issues are software interoperability issues. And it all goes back to like what happens when you bring software into the built-in environment. And like my colleague Rob was saying earlier, you have a lot of folks that have to play in this space and has to exchange information. But specifically on the charging side, we consistently see different companies, you know, create software that doesn't always play nicely. And then it's also very hard to figure out who is responsible for fixing it. This is really important from an equity perspective. I'm from South Central Los Angeles, still live in South Central Los Angeles. And I also rent. So I have an electric vehicle because I believe that, you know, gas combustion vehicles are causing all types of craziness in communities such as mine. So that's why I chose to purchase an electric vehicle. But even in that, because I rent, I don't have charging at home. I rely on my infrastructure in order to like get to work, get to a day-to-day thing. Most of the stations in my community don't work, you know? And so when we talk about some of the tools that are coming about, you know, for charger help, you know, I created a lot of the company for that exact reason. In order to solve some of these issues, we have to get more data from the field. So what we've been building out on our side has been what happens when you take a field service technician and you train them about the software, you deploy them into the field, and you can get some of the insights and the data that isn't being communicated back to the cloud. What happens when you get that data set and you amass 19 million unique data points of it from touching over 35,000 charging stations? How then can you actually start looking at not only the reliability of the stations, but helping cities procure better?
And saving money right now at Menards. From smoke and carbon monoxide detectors to fire extinguishers and more, Kidde Home Safety products keep your family protected in case of emergencies. Smoke and carbon monoxide detectors are perfect for your living spaces, offering protection and peace of mind. Save big money on all Kidde products at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. I think sometimes AI tools may be like this big lofty thing, but for us, we're using data and insights in order to bring it back to just like the simple procurement process to say to cities, hey, how about if you're deploying infrastructure in a low-income community, it should have a better percentage than 97%, because those 11 days out of the week actually impacts a lot of people from actually getting to work or getting to school, or God forbid, you know, going to do an emergency, right? Or requiring certain things about sharing data. So yes, we use cool, sexy AI tools to like amass good information to really bring it back to the basics, to ensure that we have good procurement practices and we're deploying infrastructure that the consumer could trust.
Well, I think I fully agree. And I think neighborhood and localism matters, though. I think, you know, bringing it down to the ground level, the block level, that local communities can take whatever tools, AI, or just, you know, manual data sets or Excel spreadsheet, and make that actionable and make that opening up a meaningful dialogue. So as you mentioned, a logical procurement process can happen so that improvements in the built environment and communities can affect, you know, new possibilities for addressing, whether they be mobility transit deserts, lack of EV infrastructure, or just simply access to goods and services. This is where kind of, you know, to pardon the cliche, but the rubber hits the road here, you know, and there is a gap between lofty either city or state or national level AI mandates and programs and policies. But when it comes down to the neighborhood level, it's ultimately important to be able to kind of distill that to what is addressing the pain points that cities are grappling with on a day-to-day basis. And really what I said, especially with a few past episodes, speaking with the city of Chicago and a few other episodes on Cities First, is work your way backwards. Identify your desired end state. What is your pain point? And then basically fit in the data, the AI, the technology to fit that. Don't create a situation where it's a solution looking for a problem, which I like to say is very circa 2017, 2018. That was like the peak smart cities hype. We've learned so much in the last 7 or 8 years. We don't need to repeat these cliches from the pre-pandemic era. We need to really identify ground level problems in cities and communities, whether it's South Central LA, whether it's in Seattle, et cetera, and then use the technology for the greater good. But with that, Rob, what are your thoughts on this topic?
maybe two parts of this to speak to. One is the data sourcing in combination has been kind of the perpetual thorn in the sides of many. And it almost begs a readdressing and reimagining of the problem where we say legally and structurally, how do we give different powers to different people on putting the data together, and who's in charge of that in each organization? Because we're not going to get really good at this if over and over again people get to say, no, that's mine. And what are the rules and structures that we're going to say, so and so owns this, the value of it is X, and here's how we're going to protect people. Because a part of the trade for local governments is we get to move fast when we have the trust of our community, and we will move really slow when our community distrusts us. Because our leadership will hear it at the ballot box, in elections, and for levies, whatever we put in front, the distrust will show. And so we have to earn it and keep it. And then number two is we want to move quickly and solve problems. And so that's one part of the thing that we have to solve, and we have to come up with new models rather than just lament over and over again. The other thing is the educational part of it, the solutions part of it is, in traffic management, you still see the large majority, and Jason is one of the exceptions, is people will print out the maps in traffic safety, and look at it and make their notes, and then go to the next map and make their notes, and go to the next map and make their notes as they're re-engineering things. And there are a lot better tools out there, and there are some really good partners emerging. And American Planning Association, others are kind of recognizing those, but the tools are advancing a lot faster than the education and the trade sometimes. And how do we accelerate that loop? So the continuous improvement part begs us as professionals to take a kind of another look at, are we keeping pace in our profession, in our craft? And AI is just adding not quite gasoline, but kind of quantum fuel on top of that. And I don't know if we have the right answers there, but that's why we engage in conversations like this, Scott. But on your question of the tools and mobility to improve accessibility and equity, we have to see who we're missing. We have to listen to the kind of the dark spots in the data and recognize that it's not just where the data is present, but also where it's not present, because everyone matters. We have to say how we're evolving our policies and laws and structures. It also matters how we're educating and training ourselves and getting continuous improvement perspectives in that, because we're moving into a faster phase, and using the same old tools. Fortunately, our partners are going to try to drag us faster, but we have good company in trying to solve these problems.
Yeah, there's a push and pull between the status quo of kind of the institutional, let's say, habits and ways of doing things, whether it's a planner myself, an engineer, an architect. We don't need to belabor that point, but there's a tendency towards the status quo and doing things how we've always done them, whether it's in city government or it could be in the private sector as well too. I've fallen into that trap myself many times, and sometimes it's just easier just to continue forward. But I think the rocket fuel, the jet fuel you mentioned of AI accelerating the adoption, whether it's mandatory or voluntary of these tools, will continue. And that just kind of layering into the availability and ubiquity of a lot of these scenario planning modeling tools that have been on the market the last 5, 6, 7 years, that allow for much quicker analyses above and beyond, let's say, more of the kind of traditional standard, let's say, GIS mapping. I used to be a GIS analyst myself. I'm a cartographer and urban planner, so I've made thousands of maps in my career, so I know how it is to redline those or CAD plans. But getting back to the point though, now is the time to really identify those gaps, improve the motivation on the part of the professions in cities and consultants as well too, because consultants can be just as guilty as the city employees as well, to better serve the purposes of their community and identify these gaps. But Jason, I'd love to hear your perspective on this kind of Wide
Well,
ranging topic. Or
and
yeah, go ahead.
as Jason answers, I just want to set really high expectations. He's got it all figured out for us.
Thanks, Rob.
Every piece of this is solved.
Yeah,
Go ahead,
no
Jason.
pressure.
He's going to
Thanks.
contradict everything you just said.
No, Rob has been a great partner to DOT, and they help set policy and procedure. We have an AI policy about the responsible civic use of this emerging technology, how we deploy things when we acquire new technology. It runs through a robust kind of security and privacy review. We were the first city to adopt in the nation to adopt a surveillance ordinance, which kind of governs our use. We're audited annually on our use. We're very transparent on our adoption of various technologies. But I think I'm going to focus on the Vision Zero program and safety, which is one of our primary goals. We're committed with other cities around the world to eliminate serious injuries and fatalities by the year 2030. And we've taken a number of steps in this area. We have a very talented team of engineers working on deploying mitigation strategies. We've lowered speed limits citywide to 25 miles per hour. We have leading pedestrian intervals at every of our signalized intersections, essentially giving folks a chance to get out while the vehicles are stopped. It's just a proven method to make them more apparent and less likely to be involved in a collision. But we have a couple of exciting projects. One is a federally funded grant project. It's focused in a diverse community called Rainier Valley in Southeast Seattle. And we partnered with Sound Transit, who's a light rail operator in the greater Puget Sound region. And the light rail is typically running either elevated on elevated structures or subterranean, so separated at grade, but it runs right down the middle of Martin Luther King Boulevard through 28 signalized intersections. And there's been an unfortunate history of collisions between the train and pedestrians and bicyclists. And we've tried a number of traditional engineering techniques to try and improve the safety situation. And now we have won a grant along with 50 other agencies meant to deploy and test innovations that are, available off the shelf, but perhaps not widely understood, and then provide, feedback that other agencies can take into consideration. So for us, it's a combination of AI at the edge and new camera systems. So, and really fusing the detection that AI is seeing into the infrastructure to try and dynamically change the experience and improve safety by, recognizing like, hey, this person has a mobility challenge. They're halfway across the intersection. The don't walk is coming up because they're not moving at a normal pace. Can we extend the walk dynamically to give them a safe chance to cross? We're also implementing low latency wireless communication devices that broadcast out safety messages that can be consumed by connected vehicle drivers, by autonomous vehicles, by the light rail operators, and by pedestrians on their mobile devices using C-V2X, which is a federal protocol meant to enable, communication between these different modes. So yeah, we're hoping to have success, leveraging technology to improve safety down this critical corridor. And if we're successful, we'll be eligible for a stage two of the grant, which is essentially a bulked up version of the pilot, so we can deploy at each of the 28 signalized intersections along this corridor. Another project that I'll highlight quickly is with a AI company out of the Bay, C3 AI, and we are working with them on a pilot project. So they're consuming data. We have 20 years of collision history that they're pulling in and breaking into the various elements that might contribute to a crash, the date and time, location, what types of vehicles were involved, how fast they were going, what was the weather condition, running this through a machine learning tree-based model and determining, hey, which of these various elements in combination lead to the likely outcome of a serious injury or fatality. And we see the early results are very promising, but we see how we can further strengthen this with more data, GIS information, lane widths, the existence of bike lanes, et cetera. But we're just a few months in, but we think this could be really a transformational tool in our toolkit to be more proactive in the way we introduce mitigation strategies at both the intersection, corridor, and city level.
Well, you piqued my interest with the MLK corridor in Rainier Valley. I've traveled on that before on Sound Transit going to SeaTac airports. It's interesting. It's a very challenging segment, a long segment, and the use of AI and digital tools to kind of improve more traditional engineering interventions and techniques, in terms of signal timing, in terms of barriers, et cetera, to help, let's say, improve and kind of ameliorate passenger flows and reduce some of these conflict points, as well as align with the goals of Vision Zero. Obviously, that's what we're really focused on here, which hasn't been as successful as we'd hoped for in many U.S. cities over the last 10 years. But I think we're closing the gap, though, really quickly. And we're seeing a lot of wins on the Vision Zero side, certainly in Seattle. But I think the example that you gave in Rainier Valley is interesting because I don't want to say it's a low cost, but it's a light touch intervention that can deliver higher results than kind of what has been a traditional challenge for, you know, like we said, at grade crossings. You know, we'll be honest that public transit isn't used, not necessarily as frequently, but for different contexts than Europe, Asia, and other continents. So sometimes there's a bit of a education information gap in terms of these at grade conflicts, especially for passenger rail, light rail, heavy rail that aren't elevated structures or subterranean, as you mentioned. So it's not the natural environment many for many, let's say, auto-centric commuters. So I think that whatever we have that we can utilize, especially out of the box, that is, you know, forward thinking, can improve the accessibility and equity of specific communities and be leveraged as a model and a use case for others that would want to implement either citywide writ large or for other types of uses related to kind of the promotion of active mobility, public transit, et cetera. It could be King Transit, it could be Sound Transit. It doesn't really matter what the operator is. It could be a bus, it could be rail. The modality is not important. It's the use of the technology, like I was saying, working backwards, starting with your problem that you've identified, implement the technology that fits that solution, but with an eye towards better public policy and alignment with the community goals of making communities more accessible, safer, and let's say more sustainable to get people out of their automobiles, because we want to promote ridership and utilization.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why, like you, he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Utilization of Sound Transit, of course, that would be one of the overarching goals. So how can we and CDOT and other partners help to strengthen Sound Transit to make it a safe environment in an area where there's a conflict zone? So I think that's a really great example. I appreciate the second example you sent, but I was just fixated on that, so I wanted to go off on a tangent. But thank you for sharing that. That was really exciting.
Appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, so let's move on to our next topic, which is back to equity and safety in AI and data. So how do we reduce bias and improve inclusion in many of the tools and the technologies that we see now and on the horizon so that we don't create new gaps or new conflicts between cities and private partners, between communities, and between other actors and stakeholders? So with that, let me throw this first one to Rob.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. I think on the equity and safety, there's maybe three areas that we could really dive into. One is kind of the using AI and data to recognize bias recognition. There's an investment in understanding both in practice and how we train ourselves to understand how the tools work and how to use them and not use them. There's another part of inclusive design. How do you engage the community to actually do transportation, use tools well, and to bring them into kind of co-design where it's appropriate. The other part of it is kind of accountability. Jason mentioned our surveillance ordinance. There's parts of our AI policy. We're actually on version 2 that says we will use AI, but we're going to go through responsible use structures. We're going to partner well. And the engagement part of responsible use is we don't just have a one-time conversation and tell, but on the IAP2 spectrum of community engagement, that the conversation keeps on going because community values are important and they also evolve. And so to your question on reducing bias and improving inclusion, that trust, going back to that trust equation, the say-do ratio, the feeling like you have a voice and keeping that trust ratio high, that is an ongoing process. And how AI tools use that or don't use that are going to be indicative of how successful or unsuccessful they are. One example. So on ALPR usage in communities, there is a lot of research that says that can be quite harmful to communities of color and communities of poverty. But when you listen to activists at first, that's the starting line. Once you start talking with your community and say, all right, data minimization, we're not going to recognize faces, we're not going to recognize skin color, we're going to do make and model, we're going to use the data patterns for X, we're not going to share it with certain folks unless we're required by subpoena. We're going to do a privacy portal where you can see those agreements and how we're using that. We're going to have signage up in multiple languages. All of a sudden, the community dialogue changes and said, all right, that's our values. Now, here's where we want you to actually use these technologies because we see our young ones almost getting hit on these crosswalks, or things are getting stolen in these neighborhoods, or they're being stripped and dropped off in these neighborhoods. And we want to engage as partners to make our community better. And once that dialogue becomes partnership, it becomes quite engaged, and your perception and ability to respond grows exponentially. And that's an effective community. So to your question, the equity and safety piece, that's the ideal state, but it doesn't start there. It is a trustful relationship and a two-way engagement. And the tools actually have to support that type of relationship, not just assume technology is good or bad. It is your values represented through use and engagement. But again, Jason's got it all figured out, so he just he's going to do it all.
Yeah, of course. It just hit the button. But I applaud the city of Seattle in terms of the anti-surveillance ordinance. Camille, I think you recall what happened in LA 5 years ago. Right in 2020, the lawsuit between Uber and the city of LA for the use and sharing of data and the challenge of the Fourth Amendment, the US Constitution, which was really that kind of a battle between the city and a private operator for the use and sharing of kind of private data. This is for scooter and bike share data, a little different than what we're talking about AI data, but it came back to the same points in terms of data being used maybe for malintent potentially, you know, law enforcement for you know privacy violations, et cetera, and I believe the lawsuit was eventually dropped. This was in 2021, but this was in LA, and it's interesting only because at that point there wasn't really an anti-surveillance ordinance in place of the collection of scooter or bike share data that could potentially protect citizens at that point, and this was through kind of the establishment. It was really at the genesis of MDS, Mobility Data Specification, which is you know basically shepherded by the Open Mobility Foundation, and they've done a stellar job during that process to really help regulate and manage and steward the sharing of mobility data. Albeit now AI is a new element in kind of a mobility data taxonomy or you know attribute, but it would have been great in hindsight as 2020 vision had we had some of these really smart policies that are a little bit more AI centric right now in place, maybe in LA and other cities, just as the emergence around 2019, 2020, to help, let's say, prevent this highly litigious environment, shall we say. Because we don't need to go to court, we just need to have better dialogue. Albeit the Achilles heel in the United States versus Europe. Again, I'm going to compare Europe to the US again, because I'm on this side of the pond, even though I'm an American.
Uh-oh.
I've been here for 8 years now, and you guys don't have GDPR. If you had GDPR, it'd make your life a lot easier because unfortunately, you're swimming upstream because it's such a balkanized patchwork of states and local city data ordinances, and it's very hard to synchronize and harmonize those. I'm not saying it needs to be all mandated, certainly by Washington, D.C. We know that's not quite feasible at this moment right now, but surveillance ordinance, thank you. However, I think having more harmonization across states and jurisdictions is a good path forward. But again, maybe that's a little bit too much pie in the sky here. So anyway, just some thoughts on that. Camille, maybe you could share some of your perspectives on this topic.
Yeah, I mean, I think that like as a with everything, it one, it's always interesting when people ask questions about like equity and folks in low-income communities. It's almost like this like othering. And I think like that's like the first problem is like you can solve better problems if it's being solved by the folks that are experiencing it, right? And so for me, you know, we work with the Los Angeles Clean Tech Incubator to first even come up with the ideal of our company and how we build, and even today, how we use technology, how we think about AI is from a lens. My co-founder is from Compton, myself from South Central. It's from a lens of we are the Black and Brown people from low-income communities that are not built now building. And so how we think about AI specifically around workforce development isn't around like replacing jobs. It's about how do we allow for some of the more rudimentary things to be taken care of so that way we can increase the salary of our employees and being able to essentially show more value of like their work by having like standardized things being taken care of through AI. But I think like a lot of the conversation oftentimes create like people are creating things for these communities where we should have more opportunities for folks from the community to create the things that they need. And so I think like that's always the biggest disconnect for me. And I think that's going to be the biggest hurdle for us when we talk about AI across the US. It's going to be how do we ensure that there are businesses and companies, founders, you know, that are coming from the community that can help create some of the things that they want to see. And that way they'll be the ones that are most apt to understand what they're impacted by instead of other people having to kind of like figure out what will work or won't work. I just think that we need more. I think community involvement is one thing, but we actually need more leaders, more founders, more people in charge, right, that are coming from the actual community if we want to be impactful and helpful to communities such as like South Central Los Angeles.
It's the, you know, perennial tension between top down versus bottom up. And, you know, bottom up is clearly the path forward in the 21st century. I think we've learned from all the failures of 20th century urban planning, whether it be Robert Moses, whether it be whoever, in terms of the failures of American cities and what happens, you know, abuse of eminent domain, redlining, et cetera, and how it's just destroyed communities, highway building, on and on and on. And really,
Well,
that is, you know, some of the worst you know, examples of top-down imposition of urban planning, albeit though that gets into the topic of imposition of tools and technology. So, you know, it's really consistent with if we're talking about AI tools as well as new developments that perhaps come outside of our community or are imposed versus are co-developed or are led by the community upwards. You know, and it's very kind of consistent with the concept, you know, let's say, you know, getting back to a little bit of the terminology back to urban design of like tactical urbanism, grassroots and cities and communities leading the way and designing and recreating their own public spaces, their own built environments to make them more safe, sustainable, equitable, et cetera. And technology is no different. It doesn't matter if it's digital or physical. So if we're talking about build a bike, you know, a rack, build a new path, build a new you know, pedestrian path, new markings, et cetera, that are led by communities. Well, the use and leadership of AI and tools and technologies that are, let's say, brought to market by local communities, whether it's in Compton, South Central LA, Watts, et cetera, you know, that is a real huge sea change improvement that we should, of course, we should all be championing. I think that is really going to be a game changer for Los Angeles and cities all across America. So absolutely. Jason, what are your thoughts on this?
yeah, thanks. I think for SDOT, it's, you know, analyzing trends, not necessarily, you know, and being aware of people's, you know, need for privacy. And for example, if we look at origin destination information to understand where people are, you know, where their trips are emanating from, it's at the zip code level, for example. We have a Seattle transportation plan that we launched. It's a combination. You know, we used to have various modal plans. We had a freight master plan, a pedestrian master plan, a bicycle plan. Those have been strategically aligned into a 20-year vision, a roadmap for SDOT. And we recently, last year, passed a voter initiative for additional real estate tax to help fund over the next 8 years, a $1.5 billion infusion for us to improve sidewalks, roadway condition, and just the transportation experience. So there's a lot of, community support for our agency. And we're trying to develop projects and look at various equity quartiles and understand the needs really at the community level. What types of transportation modalities do these folks use? We have a tremendous surge in micro mobility usage in Seattle last month. For the first time, we exceeded 1 million Lime rides, scooter rides in June. And it's truly not a fringe option. I mean, it's like the way that people travel from A to B every day. My daughter's 13 years old. Her and her friends, I mean, they just use this. It's just an accepted method for travel. And so being able to look at ridership across all the various modes, understand where the high injury networks, where the safety concerns, and how can we best deploy solutions that provide the greatest benefit based on the needs of the community. With our operational technology, we did a project to kind of look at, hey, you know, what combination of devices are installed at each intersection and what treatments can we provide as a result, assign kind of a maturity score for that, for those treatments, and then can look at that at sort of the corridor or neighborhood level. So I think it's just kind of stepping back and looking at holistically the needs of the community and trying to provide treatments to provide benefit both to our constituents and to visitors in Seattle.
Well said, Jason. You shared some points that are very near and dear to my heart. First of all, I want to thank Rob. I know you're going to be leaving early, but we appreciate your contribution. We'll continue for a little bit longer here. But Jason, to your points, as an urban transportation planner, the siloed approach to transportation planning is 20th century, and that is over. So when you have a transportation, you have a pedestrian plan, you have a cycling plan, and these are all separate documents. That is being fused into a multimodal, let's say, process. The city of Seattle is obviously taking the leadership in this, but it's not alone. Many cities across America are now, such as Chicago and others, are focused on this kind of, comprehensive approach to multimodality, understanding that there are new shared and active modes that have gained prominence over the last five, six, 7 years, and they're not going away. As you mentioned, Lime rides, et cetera, et cetera. Cities such as Paris should have taken note before they banned scooters in 2023, because scooters were widely popular in Paris. However, became kind of a political project because, you know, the mode share of scooters was on par with bike share in Paris. And really, had they listened better to the citizens, especially the younger generations, we're talking Gen Z, Gen Alpha, millennials, because there's a generational divide here. With modalities as well as cultural, racial, demographic, et cetera. Had they really listened to the consumer demand of who's using these, who's booking these rides, they would have never actually banned the scooters. So that use case I mentioned in Paris went sideways because they had Lime scooters there. They had all the other operators and they got them off the street, albeit shared bikes are very popular there. And I only mention that is because Again, matching generational preferences, consumer demand, as well as trends in how we move, recreate, and work throughout cities has changed massively since the pandemic. And our planning and policy process is starting to very quickly mirror and emulate that in a positive way. So we're getting away from these traditional civil engineering, urban planning centric silos of these very kind of disconnected planning element documents to much more coherent, interconnected, holistic documents that put mobility at the core. That is the common thread across our metropolitan and, communities. We all are impacted by mobility and transportation. And if we view things through that lens, whether it's technology or traditional urban planning, we can see that the interconnectedness provides opportunities so that we can better deliver services as well as results to citizens where there are unmet demands. And I think that that is really a positive trend that I'm seeing in city government, as well as kind of just this kind of move away from that traditional urban transportation land use planning process to something that's a bit more 21st century. So you have just corroborated my own observations and opinions. So it's music to my ears, Jason. Thank you for sharing that. So let's move on to kind of our final topics here. Let's maybe wrap it up just maybe 2 minutes or so from each of you guys. Maybe Camille, give us some real world examples from LA, or let's say to get really local, let's say south of the 10 freeway, the Santa Monica freeway, south of Adams Boulevard. And let's focus on what do you see happening in those communities that's really exciting you right now?
Yeah, I was like, oh, you are from LA. Okay, yes.
I'm from Culver City, Pasadena, and Santa Monica. I'm an Angelina.
You understand. Okay.
Go Lakers.
Yes, the things that I'm most excited about, I'm actually sitting in a space right now that was put together through a public-private partnership with the LA Clean Tech Incubator and one of the local government officials to establish one of the nation's first ever EBSC technician training centers. And so this is bringing charging infrastructure here in South Central Los Angeles, where folks have not only access to it, but also understanding of that new technology space, because it goes back to what I was saying earlier. If we're not a part, if everyone is in a, I hate the word top down, so that's the only thing I was going to call out, but if, because clearly how we've been doing it hasn't been working. So if everyone—
Not in the 20th century, no, it's been a failure.
Right. So like if everyone isn't a part of learning, understanding, and most importantly, being inspired.
Yes.
To participate and to be a part of community and be a part of solutioning, then I don't know where we're going to go. So this is something I'm really excited about. This facility also from time to time houses organizations like LATech.org, which they've been doing a lot of work in regards to getting more folks from certain communities into the technology space to get them exposed to larger technology career paths. And so we posted them. We've hosted other folks that have really also focused on soft skills. So that's the other thing with like AI and all of these things. Like the most important thing moving forward is going to be how we work with one another in person. How do we treat one another? And there's an organization that comes here and do that. So I'm really excited to be, here in a space that is facilitating what I believe are the next leaders of our generation to help fix a lot of things that have not been fixed yet.
Sorry, I thought I was muted. So Jason, maybe some final thoughts on this topic in your experience in Seattle.
Yeah, I think one thing that comes to mind is just taking better advantage of the tremendous talent in the tech industry that's in the greater Seattle region. You know, we have campuses, obviously Microsoft's headquartered here. But there's campuses for Amazon and for Google as well. We've done a few different projects with them and also with the University of Washington. So building on that strategic, you know, and creating a strategic alignment between resources, because they have needs and desires to safely and efficiently move their staff. And we can take advantage of a lot of evolution in this space to transform our work, in particular around making decisions with better data. We have highly siloed data sources. You know, we've just evolved over the years, like many agencies and tech companies. And we have, you know, data on people's desks and spreadsheets or in various databases, and being able to create sort of a shared data governance model where we can say, hey, this is the source of truth for our information, and include, you know, traffic data, include safety data, financial data, the current state of our asset can really transform our decision making. We're also partnering with Google on Project Greenlight. So this is a sustainability effort to try and merge signal timing with Google congestion data. They give us recommendations on how we can tweak signal timing to try and reduce vehicle idling, which is the biggest contributing factor from transportation to CO2 emissions. So I think just being very strategic in the way that we could take advantage of these resources that are at our disposal to transform our work and provide that benefit to all of our citizens is the path forward.
Right. Do you guys have time, like maybe 2 minutes for one question? We got a question that popped up on our chat. I don't know would you be okay to stick around just a little bit to field this?
Sure.
Okay, great. So the question, Camille, I'll let you start on this, is, let me get this for you. Right now. Looks like the question dropped off. I apologize. Well, okay. Anyway, okay, I think we'll just wrap it up here. So, with that, I want to thank you both, Camille, Jason, as well as Rob, who departed a little bit early, for your time today. This has been a very inspiring, thought-provoking discussion. It's clear that there's much work to be done, but I believe the opportunity is there, and now we've learned some, albeit painful, lessons over the last few years since the pandemic, and certainly over the last century of our urban planning, policies, that we are really kind of focused on better use cases, a better dialogue with communities, and really trying to empower communities to kind of lead from the bottom up and really try to take charge in terms of not necessarily just be tech driven or tech enabled, but also utilizing the best innovations to solve the challenges that they deal with on a regular basis. So, with that, Camille and Jason, I really want to thank you for your time. It's been a sincere pleasure. I'd also like to just mention to the audience that this episode has been sponsored by UMX by EIT Urban Mobility, and you can view all of their content on urbanmobility.eu for continuing education on this topic. But once again, thanks, Jason and Camille. Appreciate your insights. This has been a real pleasure today.
Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Thank you.